Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon or good evening, wherever you're at on the time zone. This is Rhonda Harrison broadcasting live from Roadmap for Seekers with John Davidson today. He's an author. His first book, The Soul's Critical Path, Waking Down to the Soul's Purpose, the Body's Power, and the Heart's Passion, was published in 2013. It immediately gained the endorsement of well-known shamanic teacher Sandra Ingram, who said the book John takes us into a powerful and deep exploration of the soul's path. The soul's critical path offers a new and fresh perspective to help us on our spiritual journey. I found the book to be very insightful as well as brilliantly written. That book was followed quickly by two more books, Soul Tribes and Taboos, Community for Souls on the Move and The Left Hand of God, A Soul's Love Poems, both published in 2014. He is two more books in the process, including Soul Mating 345, Three Questions, Four Rules, Five Questions, and Traction, Three Steps for Grounding Passion of Soul Purpose on a Chaotic Planet. Davidson says that his writing provides and describes the construct behind his unique hands-on soul coaching practice developed over several decades. His current project, entitled Traction, will provide a concise description of that practice intended to explain how he teaches clients on the massage table with a combination of guided visualization, specific cranial sacral and breathing techniques, and a non-classic shamanic journey taken by the awakened soul into the timeline of the body's experience. Although his primary clients are serious spiritual practitioners, he also adapts to coach practice to people approaching the death of the body and the transition of the soul. His website is www.soulcriticalpath.com. With that, I'll bring John into the studio, who's with us today. And John,
good morning, Rhonda.
Good morning. And it's very good to have you on the show today. I know that you've been writing books and you do, you know, a lot with sustainable communities as well. And as a writer, you present yourself as a soul coach. And what's the background of experience that you have with that type of work?
When I talk about my experience, Rhonda, I frequently hear myself starting off as a child and talking about why my childhood experience was significant to what I'm doing now. And I mm-hmm. do believe that whatever we're doing at the present moment is a consequence of what we've done throughout our lives. But in my case, I grew up in the small town I'm living in now in northeastern New Mexico, a rural coal mining town. And what was significant about that experience was the land itself. And I grew up in the 50s and was just a few blocks from the foothills of the Sangre de Cristos, the Rocky Mountains. And whenever it was warm enough and we weren't in school, we were on our bikes heading to the hills, or we had our backpacks, and by the time we were 12 years old, we were dragging our bedrolls up the hills, and just being out in nature. And I didn't understand the significance of that until probably 10 or 15 years ago, but it was a significant relationship with the land that many children are missing these days. And mm-hmm. I think that relationship with the land was the foundation of my experience. What what began to pick up in a more classically spiritual context for me was a resonance with meditation. I started transcendental meditation when I was 28. That worked so well I had to quit because it was unlayering me and bringing up emotional reactions that I had successfully buried as a young lawyer. Started practicing law at 24 years old. So I did that for a few years and then quit, knowing that I would come back to it at some time. And in my late 30s, early 40s, sometime in there, I was initiated into Swami Rama's yoga philosophy tradition and started meditating in that more Asian way, learning the mantras and so on. At the same time I was doing that, I was engaged in Native American ceremony with a friend here in northeastern New Mexico whose background was Nipmuc. His mother was full-blood Nipmuc Indian, and he in his later life was rediscovering his Asian roots. So we did a lot of ceremonial work together, sometimes with Native American or Navajo shamans from the Navajo reservation in western New Mexico. And he introduced me to a gentleman up in Colorado by the name of John Milton, who taught vision questing, which was, in a sense, really my return to the land. That is, Milton had a process for sticking you out on the side of the hill for 6 days, drawing a circle and not leading it, and not doing anything. And it forced you into an intensive relationship with the land, taking you out of your head, so that you just had to be there. And I did six of those six-day vision quests during the 90s and established a conscious connection with the land that was quite incredible in terms of the peak experiences that many of us just yearn for when we are doing our so-called spiritual work. That had a deep influence on me. But what threw me then into my current path was a phone call from my vision questing partner back in year 2000. She called and said, "John, there's a shaman from Peru down in Santa Fe that you need to meet." And, you know, I can't even remember that I had heard the word shaman in year 2000. I may have, but I'm not sure. So I hopped in my pickup and raced down to Santa Fe and met this guy, wound up following back to Peru. And I've been in Peru at least once a year for the last 15 years, studying with indigenous shamans, studying the mountain mystical tradition, which is quite different. And then creating out of that diverse experience of meditation, which I've done steadily now for almost 30 years, and out of the indigenous perspective, creating a fusion of two very different traditions that have created the foundation of my coaching at this point. I know that's a long answer.
Well, yeah, but it's very in-depth, and it's very informational because, I mean, I think being in the United States, as you talked about in your book, it's like being in the spiritual marketplace where you have all these different choices, but how do you make a choice or how do you find out about these choices? And, you know, and I think a lot of it is anymore, you know, spirit wakes us up and we start traveling in that realm, you know, or having connections that, you know, we wouldn't usually have, and it really intensifies your spiritual process, I think. But it's also about making it your own, to which it sounds like you've done that, with the emphasis being that you still are teachable, you know, and looking more for more answers. But you break it down in your book very well as to how it's so important not to make it as difficult as some of us think it is to get that spiritual path.
I think simplicity is, simplicity is a buzzword. Lots of people like to think what they're doing is simple, and it's not really. And yet I think this is one of the most rich and at the same time confusing spiritual times in human evolution. America is really very unique. We have every spiritual tradition in the world coming to our shores, and it's available in workshops from from indigenous teachers, from American teachers, and it comes to us translated as it hits our shores. There is so much to select from that it's very confusing to know how to select. And that's a challenge that I've faced, as many other people have faced. And one thing that rings in my ears, some good advice about that, comes from a guy who's now 81 years old. He's the spiritual head of the Karo Nation, which is a small group of indigenous people that live between 12 and 18,000 feet on a sacred mountain in southern Peru that are associated with the Inca tradition. This is Don Humberto Sanco Quespi, which translates to Humberto Crystal Heart. I heard him speak in 2004 in the Sacred Valley, and what he said was that their children will not learn their traditions because they're coming off the mountain and heading for the city, just like people in our country are doing. He said, you white people, and he was addressing a group of about 20 or 30 people that I was a member of on a tour in Peru, said, you white people need to learn our traditions, take them to America, mix and match and evolve them. That really stuck in my head, and then I realized about 10 years later, that's exactly what I was doing. And I noticed he didn't say take them to Europe. He didn't say take them to Australia or Canada. He said take them to America. And what he was observing in those days was that we are the spiritual smorgasbord. We're the cauldron. This is where everything is getting mixed and matched together. But he didn't say you have to go deep in this tradition. This is the only tradition. He said evolve it. And I think that is probably the wisest thing I've ever heard a spiritual teacher say. Times are changing around us. Time is changing around us. And we need to learn how to be able to move in that flow and adapt. That's what he was talking about.
Yeah, and I do think that's very important, that learning how to adapt these principles into our lives, because, I mean, I've interacted with different Pacos out of Peru and different shamans from around the world, and and it is a blending and a mixing of things from different indigenous groups that is making this new spiritual path so exciting, is that there isn't as many divisions or lines drawn in the sand in regards to, well, it has to be done just this way or it has to be just done this way. There's more openness to, you know, developing what you personally need for yourself, is not all things are going to fit the same person the same way, depending on their background.
Well, and at the same time, I think individual spiritual development does have an underlying process that all of us need to understand at some level. What I've observed, for example, having participated in a meditative tradition for now 30 years that has come to us primarily as the gift of Asia, is that it serves both purposes that all meditation techniques serve. What I tell my meditation students is that all meditation techniques teach you how to control attention and have an opinion about where you ought to put it. But if we look at the evolution of consciousness and meditation as a technique for the evolution of human consciousness and put that on a timeline, what we might see is that the Asian creation of this technique for controlling attention is also associated with a particular perception about where we ought to put that attention. And that attention, by and large, has been placed out of the body and in what language would only help us say is an upward direction. In other words, let's put that attention in unity consciousness. And of course, I've made a sweeping generalization when I say that, but in general, the dynamic of Asian meditation has been to focus that attention to a singularity in order to get that experience of oneness. And that's what I was working with before year 2000, and I had many peak experiences. I felt that connection that we associate with unity consciousness. When I went into the jungle with the shamans, what I found is they weren't teaching people how to control their attention, but they were using plant medicines that help take people's attention into the earth. And the shamanic perspective was, we need to pay attention to what's going on in the body and on the planet. And so what I began to realize is that I already had an attention skill, and that I could quickly follow the shaman in a little different direction and find my way back into the body and find my way more deeply into a connection with the earth. And then I had a whole new perspective and a whole new experience than I had when I was simply meditating in that Asian tradition. That's not to say that there have been no practitioners in the Asian tradition who have been unconcerned with earth or with body, but at the level of the indigenous, you find a fully developed focus upon the body. So I began to shift my focus, and I got an entirely different experience and an experience within the body with which I'm much more content. I feel far more grounded, and that grounding gave me the opportunity to understand something about a soul purpose. And that is what I wound up teaching.
And when you're doing that, you know, shift, you know, from identity to soul as a matter of experience, you know, I think that if you could speak about that, because I think that's one of the things a lot of us do have a hard time with, because we have been taught to meditate outside of ourselves rather than going inward and into nature to find that special connection with the plant medicines and with various forms of aromatherapy and that type of thing.
I think it's helpful, first of all, to place this whole process in an evolutionary sequence again.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm seeing that is that the focus in our culture upon healing has, first of all, is a focus upon healing. It's not a focus upon soul purpose. If you look at Pew Research, we know that about 80% of Americans believe in souls. But if you take a room of people and ask them whether they believe in souls, most of, you know, in a spiritual context, almost everybody raises their hands. And then if you ask them if they believe that they are a soul, less people raise their hands. If you ask how many people believe they or experience themselves as a soul instead of a body, almost nobody raises their hands. And I found that to be some interesting feedback. When I went into the jungle and had the plant medicine experience with the first shaman that I worked with, I had an experience in the ceremony in which I saw a light body emerge from my body and then re-enter the body in the region of my heart. And it was in the midst of what I can only describe as an ecstatic experience. I felt deeply connected, firmly held, deeply loved in that moment, but I had no clue what the vision meant. It was probably almost 9, 10, 11 years later that thing that entered my body announced itself, identified itself, and I could only in my mind put the word soul on that. I was able to identify through these experiences some aspect of me that was not the body, and yet it had a relationship to the body. At some point, it literally spoke, and in the process of that more than a decade of work, my identity gradually shifted to that soul. That is, I experienced myself as a soul and did no longer experience myself as a body. And yet, my soul was oriented toward the body. In the shamanic, indigenous shamanic perspective, you find, in fact, we find in all of the shamanic teaching in this country, the practice of soul retrieval. What the indigenous shamans have taught us is that there is an inherent problem when the soul leaves the body. And what the shamans do, and they haven't traditionally taught the villagers to do this, what the shamans do is go into trance, reach out, recover the soul, and bring it back into the body by blowing it into the heart. The what I've found is that that is an allopathic practice. That is, we rely on somebody else to go find our soul and blow it back into our body. If we're skillful, we can be the soul and situate ourselves in the body and begin to heal our own bodies directly from that posture, from that position, and from that perspective. That's the big shift in my teaching. And what I teach people is how to embrace an identity experientially, not from a position of belief, but from an experience that they are the soul and that they can position themselves in the body with skillful attention, and from that posture begin to heal the body directly. And it makes all the difference in the world. It has totally shifted my own connection with my own body and how I feel in it.
Yeah, and it seems, well, for me, it seems like it's taken time to get to this place of, you know, where we're at today, you know, where Black Elk has talked about the Rainbow Bridge and where all the different indigenous would be coming out with their information and sharing in a more open way. And, it, you know, and you have a very interesting technique that I'd like you to explain to the listeners in regards to using cranial sacral work and massage table so that people can experience that soul movement.
Well, I can describe a session to you if you like. Mm-hmm. Maybe helpful. Would that be a good way to approach this?
Yeah, that would be great. Mm-hmm.
Well, when I sit with a client, first of all, I understand that I'm not doing psychotherapy. I'm not interested in diagnosing, and diagnosis has almost nothing to do with my process. Mm-hmm. But I am interested in some story. In other words, a therapist will listen to a story in order to make a diagnosis and prescribe a treatment, or to try to develop some practical shift or adaptation of response to the situation that a client is in. I need to hear what is on my client's mind, primarily to hear how they understand the world. I want to know what their worldview is. I want to see how they situate themselves in the world. I want to know if they identify with their body. I want to know if they identify with their wounding. I want to know if they see themselves as victims in the world. I just want to see where they are situating their identity. Who are they? Because ultimately, I'm helping them answer the question of, who am I? So I want to listen to a point, but I don't need to hear 5 stories or 10 stories, because one or two stories will tell me what their perspective on the world is. So I need to listen first and get that worldview. Then I will explain to my clients that I have a construct, that is, a different way. I call this a different way of looking. I call this construct a soul perspective. It's how the soul, a self-identified soul, sees the world, which is a different way than a victim perspective, for example, or simply a body-based perspective. And I'll explain to them their worldview is a filter. It's something they carry in their head and in their bodies, which are two different things. That is, we hold experience mentally, but we also hold it physically. I'll explain to them that they are holding that experience as a filter through which all new experiences comes as they present to new experience and have to respond to it. So what I ask them to do is not believe what I'm going to tell them, but to, for the moment, remove their filter and put my filter in. It's almost like I'm saying, here, put these colored glasses on. Take your glasses off, put my glasses on, and let's go have an experience from that perspective. And that conversation routinely takes about an hour. My sessions all run about 2 hours. So in the first hour, I'm working with that filter. I want the client to soften their filter, open up their filter, give me some room to put a new idea in. And one of the biggest challenges I have with clients is what P.D. Ouspensky once said. He said, you know, my biggest challenge with an audience is getting them to understand that I'm telling them something new. instead of just putting what they already know in different words. So I'm trying to tell my client, this is new. Please take off your glasses. Put my glasses on for a few minutes. You don't have to believe what I'm saying, because if this works, you're going to have your own new filter that you can work with. You can piece this together from your own experience. So that first hour is just helping my client loosen up enough to experience the second hour. Second hour, we go to the table. And so my client will lay on a table on their back, fully clothed, covered up with a blanket or two, and I will sit at the head of the table behind the client, and I will start off with a cranial sacral occipital hold. Back in 2001, I started working with a shamanic teacher who used this cranial sacral occipital hold to put the clients in what he called a trance. I don't treat it as a trance. What I'm telling my clients is, I need to get you to a deeply relaxed, receptive state, which I think is more accurate than trance.
Mm-hmm.
So I use that cranial sacral hold for two things. One, it helps relax the client. That's what any cranial sacral therapist is trying to do with that hold, is to help relax the client. Secondly, I'm using my fingers to palpate the cerebral spinal fluid pulse. In other words, with my fingers at the base of the occiput, I can feel the cerebral spinal fluid pulse. And that information lets me know the state of engagement, whether the client is relaxed or not relaxed, whether they're activated or not activated, and whether their response is shifting as we move through that session. And for one reason or another that I don't understand, I can also see that in my own vision space. I can see that pulse, and it gives me lots of information. Often tells me when to interrupt the client's experience to ask a question. So we start off just getting the client relaxed with that cranial sacral technique. The second thing I do while I'm working with that cerebral spinal fluid pulse is to have the client breathe in a particular way. And I describe that as breathing deeply, slowly, gently, and silently. But what I explain to them before we get onto the table is that I'm using a technique that's very research-based. I draw that breathing technique primarily from the research done by the Institute of Heart Math, HEARTMATH. If you've never heard about them, look up heartmath.org. This is an organization in Northern California that I trained with back in 2004, is developing the best body of research on heart intelligence, I think, in modern science. And what they've developed is a biofeedback program that tells you whether you are creating a state of heart coherency, which I'll come back to later. But heart coherency winds up being a term to describe where we need to get, and it reflects when the soul is in the body and the body feels calm and has accepted the soul. So I start them with that breathing technique. And the technique basically is this. When I say deeply, I mean breathe abdominally. Well, anybody who's had any meditation training or any yoga training has learned about breathing abdominally. By slowly, I mean breathe 5 seconds in, 5 seconds out. But I tell my clients 5 seconds in and 5 seconds out takes some skill. What I really want them to do is count and be aware of how long they are able to breathe in the third way, which is gently. And on any given day, even if you've learned 5 seconds in and 5 seconds out, it doesn't do any good to do that if you have to force it. So I'm wanting them to breathe at that particular level on a particular day that they can breathe deeply and gently. And when I say silently, I just want them to check into the sound of their breathing in their nose. And if they can hear their breathing and don't have allergies and not otherwise clogged up, the nose sound will tell you that you're pushing it a little bit too hard. So if they can hear the sound going through their nose, I have them back it off a little bit and find that sweet spot where in that moment the body is going to find its optimal relaxation by virtue of what they are doing and what I'm doing in that moment. So That's the second step. We start with craniosacral, we go to breathing, and then we do a guided visualization. And this falls entirely within the fake it until you make it process. We are demonstrating, helping somebody, demonstrating to somebody a pathway they can follow to get an experience if they follow it long enough. So that consists of this. I have them use intention and imagination. And I always explain that imagination gets a bad rap in American culture. Imagination is treated as something we make up and isn't real. But if you read the literature, imagination has a rich tradition. This is how the heart thinks. It's how the heart navigates. It's how our visionary mental capacity makes connections. So what I tell them is use your imagination and call all of your attention back from wherever it has gone. This today, this week, last year, this lifetime, any former lifetime. It's your attention. You get to control it. So I give them 10 seconds, 15 seconds, call it back, and I have them visualize that attention arriving just in front of the chest in the form of a sphere of light, gaining in brilliance as that attention arrives, and then we fairly quickly move it into the center of the chest. And I label this process for them. I tell them the center of the chest is also the center of a mysterious function that we're going to call the heart portal. Heart is a broadly used word. We use it to describe the physical heart, the emotional heart, the heart chakra, and I tell my clients we're doing a fourth thing here. We're describing a juncture where the immortal soul can communicate with the mortal body. But it's located in terms of the body sensuality in the center of the chest. So I have them bring that brilliant sphere of light into the center of the chest, have them label that the heart portal, and then we label that brilliant sphere of light the soul. And I say, this is who you are. That brilliant little sun, part of the great sun behind our earth sun, that's who you are. You are the soul. To make a longer story short, I have them flood the soul into the body very gently with the permission of the body, very respectfully, without presumption. The soul invites the body to invite the soul in. And then I go through a process that takes about another 15 minutes in which we connect the soul with heaven, which is just my buzzword for those other higher vibrational dimensions, and with earth, the heart of the earth, which is my buzzword for a mystery that we don't understand but with which we can connect. That is, the earth has the capacity to share love with the body. And we use the soul as the facilitator to bring love into the body, to flood the body with love. That is a healing event in itself, but now it's a healing event facilitated by you, by my client. And then once that is done, and depending on where we are in the work with the client, I used to take clients out of body to do a classic shamanic journey. We would go someplace, get some information. But what I finally learned was that it's much more efficient to have the soul simply move and journey in the timeline of the body. That is, to let that soul, which is the very essence of love, a drop of heaven, to move in the timeline of the body and simply be an observer. It's amazing what comes out of the body in that timeline. That's a healing process, but it's still not my focus. The focus is to teach the client how to do this on a routine basis, how to flood the body with that love so that we can reach another juncture, which is to get rid of the static in the body that prevents the soul from listening through the body's heart and its sensuality for soul purpose. I'm going to take a breath there.
That's fine.
How we find soul purpose is another trick. You know, we talk about destiny and fate, and we tend to think that we're going to find soul purpose printed on something or maybe on the back of our forehead. But, you know, fate is something that just happens to us. Destiny is something we create. Fate is lemons, destiny is lemonade. But the world's changing around us all the time, so we have to learn how to create destiny in a continually changing environment. And as it turns out, we find our destiny by the soul sitting in the heart portal, using the body's sensuality made available because the static has been put aside by your self-healing, and then feeling what you're drawn to. And on every day, there will be opportunities to which you are drawn. And this is the essence of the true law of attraction, which is not about what we want, but about what wants us. The universe wants us to deliver our soul gifts in an effective way, and it calls to us. And on any given day, we'll have multiple opportunities, but one will have more resonance. And if we let ourselves be drawn in that direction, at some time later, our minds might understand why we got drawn in that direction. And this is key to understand. We don't find destiny in our minds. We find it in our hearts. So I say to people, heart tells you where to go. Mind makes the reservations. Once you know where you need to go, your mind will engage to figure it out. That's the process.
And it seems to be so subtle, but yet very powerful at the same time, due to the way that you do it, and it's not a forced situation or trying to get someone to a certain point, but getting to that point of relaxation and centering more on the breathing and the heart center, that, or the gut center, as I call it sometimes, because, you know, people say follow your gut, and a lot of people don't get that concept. They think it's something that they have to work towards rather than, you know, being more contemplative with getting there in a softer, easier manner.
It's awfully helpful, Rhonda, to approach this from the perspective that the soul is one entity and the body is another entity. There are two of us here. And if you listen to your inner dialogue, you know, people are always saying, I've been having an argument with myself. Well, there are two of you, and they're having that argument at least. And that may come from a variety of places. But what I found is actually treating these two as two separate entities and then associating identity with one gives us a way to approach the heart, the gut, the brain, the visionary capacity, the analytic capacity, instead of getting lost in it. If I think I'm my thoughts, or if I think I'm the fear in my gut, it gets confusing real quick. You don't have the ability to stand back from it. And merely standing back from it without an identity to put yourself in makes it easy to get lost too. And I have to say, this is what mindfulness meditation invites. It's one thing to back away from your thoughts and emotions. It's another thing to know who you are when you're standing away from those. Soul has an identity. It exists. It is something. And I found that as I've experienced myself as soul, body, I'm able to allow my body to be something else. And I don't have to limit my body or, in fact, dictate to my body. My body is a wild thing. That's what I learned in these indigenous settings. My body is very powerful. My body, if you think of the Robert Redford movie, The Horse Whisperer, you find this essentially wild horse standing out in the pasture that nobody can ride. Robert Redford sits at the edge of the pasture until the horse begins to notice him, notices that he's not threatened, but he feels the connection. Soul and body have an inherent connection, but it doesn't mean they're in relationship. What Robert Redford was able to do was create a relationship with the horse and become the only one who could ride that horse. Well, your body will not let anybody ride it except the soul, but the soul is going to have to create and take the lead in creating that relationship. And the last thing the soul wants to do is to tame this body. We're not talking about taming the body. We're talking about creating a relationship in which the body turns to the soul, falls in love with the soul, and offers its extraordinary power and sensuality into service of the soul's destiny, of the soul's delivery of its gift on the planet.
So in your book, you talk about how the soul evolves during an individual lifetime, and if we foster that evolution, soul is an entity distinct from the body, like you just said. But it's important to shift those two identities and to know if you're, from what I'm understanding, knowing when you're in the body realm and when you're in the soul realm. And it seems that, you know, we tend to be more passionate from a soul level sometimes than we are from the physical, you know. Or
We can't be passionate unless the soul is engaged, but we can't be passionate unless the body has connected to the soul. So it absolutely requires relationship. Just think of our interpersonal relationships. We are drawn to people. We feel that strong connection. We know we are in some way fated to be with them, and yet we immediately engage in war with them because we don't have a relationship. We have a connection, but not a relationship, and we confuse connection and relationship. Well, connection simply exists. It's fate. Relationship is destiny. Relationship is something that has to be skillfully created. Well, the skill is in learning how to control attention, knowing that attention is the soul, and bringing that attention to the juncture in the body where it can create a relationship, and the relationship is based in love. The soul has to create experiences for the body in which the body feels safe enough to release its wounding, and connected enough to the soul that it will turn to the soul and create and reciprocate in that relationship. And when that happens, which has been called in the literature the marriage of the masculine and feminine, body's the feminine, soul is the masculine in this particular way of talking about it, it's the soul that penetrates the body that receives. When that relationship is actually consummated, passion arises, and you know it. There isn't any mistaking it. It arises in the chest and explodes all around you. If you have to ask, am I feeling passion? The answer is no. You're not. When you feel it, you'll know it. But this happens when the body, in all of its wildness, turns and consents to be the partner of the soul because relationship has arisen. The problem we most of us face, and this is what I don't talk about the coaching process in the book, but I do talk about this evolutionary process in the book. And this is where most of us face the challenge. In the book, I talk about Plato's story of a soldier who had a near-death experience on the battlefield. And what that soldier did was go out of body, and he was able to watch the processing of souls coming to the planet. And what to make that long story, and I think it's an interesting story, but to make it very short, what the soldier saw was that souls knew that they were souls when they were in that place of getting ready to come to the body. They knew who they were. They may not have been very smart. They may not have been wise. They may not have been very evolved, but they knew they were souls. And the last thing that happened in the process of getting them ready to come on the planet, which was a very interesting story that Plato told, the last thing that happened was that they were told to drink from the river of forgetting. And so they came onto the planet and into the body in this flash of thunder and lightning, as Plato tells the story. But they forgot who they were, and they merge into the body. And there was a reason for that forgetting, but they merge into the body not remembering who they were. And so we wake up after the momentum of our teenage years and the drive of our 20-something years. At some point, we begin to slow down in response to pain in our body. Something has happened to us. Fate challenges all of us. And we begin to understand that we don't understand, that we're overwhelmed with pain or confusion or complexity or chaos in our lives. And as it works, these are things that we're naturally avoiding. In our culture says avoid these. Here, take this pain pill. So you don't have to feel that pain. But in fact, the pain is the design. This is the intelligent design of humans. The pain is programmed into us to catch our attention and focus our attention until we can see that we need to figure out who we are and what's going on. Pain drives the soul out of the body. It does disassociate us. And as we pick up a meditation practice, we learn to disassociate even better. And we find that we if we are very good at meditation, we can meditate ourselves right back up into the heaven realm where we came from. And what happened? We either go into unity consciousness, or we go into unity consciousness and remember where we came from, that we are a soul. And with that memory that we are a soul, all of a sudden we can turn our face back to the planet, remember why we came, and say, oh, I got to get that body into a partnership with me so I can deliver my gift on the planet. And that's where my process works. I help people remember who they are, give them an experience of who they are, and help them orient back to the body so they can get their gift onto the planet. That's where purpose comes in. And so that's the evolution. That's the critical path. We know who we are, we forget who we are, we remember who we are, and we get to work with the body, dive back into the body, and get on the planet.
And I like how you say that, you know, it's a growing process between, you know, the teen years, the 20s, the 30s, because it seems like how I've looked at it, you know, in numerous times in my life, it's kind of like an uptake of information by becoming more vulnerable to the soul and feeling the pain that you described, you know, and finding ways to interact with the soul that doesn't really relate to the body as much until you get to that point of submission or enlightenment that, you know, you're two different entities, but yet you work as a team versus then against each other as much.
It takes a lot of insight to get to that point. And Carl Jung said that the door to the soul opens at about 40 years of age. And this is when most of my clients come. They come after 40 because they have the spiritual impulse, but they know that they don't understand why they're in so much pain, and they're trying to put things together, and that's when they're amenable to some work. So I think historically, in the course of human evolution, we have this kind of natural maturation. We get to a point, say 40 years old, between 40 and 50, and I think Hume said the door started closing again after 50.
Mm-hmm.
But so there's a ripeness in there for this work, but I also think that that's changing. As I look, as I've traveled and talked with young people in Peru and in on the West Coast, to some degree in India, and I listen to their stories, and I almost interview them because I want to know their stories. What I'm seeing is that there are a lot of old souls coming onto the planet that didn't forget who they were. They're coming, you know, they know as young children or as teenagers that they are souls. They know that they're here on purpose. They know that they've got some work to do. They even may know what their gift is. But what I'm finding is they can't get traction. They don't know how to ground it on the planet. They're looking at a bunch of adults who've screwed this up so badly that we're in a chaos that is hard to navigate. They don't know what to do here. That's why I'm writing the book called Traction. I'm really addressing it to people who know that they're here on purpose, whether they're in their 40s or 50s. Or there may be young people, but they're not sure how to get traction. So I'm teaching, you know, this whole thing on the table is, this is where the rubber meets the road. I can help you get traction right there.
And it appears or looks like that you, by doing the sacral cranial work, are opening those portals that aren't usually open due to being so distracted by what's going on in the world, whereas you help, from what I understand, quiet the individual so that they can have that experience, their soul.
I think that's exactly the essence and highest application of cranial sacral therapy, is that the body is in our world, the body's in reaction all the time. It's continually in a defensive posture. Cranial sacral work, when it gets beyond the micro adjustments of bones and the harder tissues, allows the body to feel safe. And nothing can happen until the body feels safe. This is what we're learning in the work with people diagnosed with PTSD. Nothing can happen until the body can have an experience of feeling safe. So that's where I'm finding the valuable application of cranial sacral therapy. It's what gets the ball rolling. But it's the soul that then steps in and takes responsibility for enhancing that sense of safety to a point where the body isn't in a defensive posture continuously and can begin to exercise its own power and bring its own energy into the world. And when that happens, Rhonda, this is one of the most remarkable experiences I've had. When the body feels safe, it not only can let the soul in, and that can not only let the world, it can not only face the world and let the world come in, but it lets life force come in. The earth informs the body with life force, just as the soul informs the body with purpose and design. When that life force can come up, and we have called this in the Asian traditions Kundalini, but the Kundalini doesn't do much good if you don't have the soul in place, and the soul in place doesn't do much good unless you can open the body to receive that life force. This is when everything comes together. Not only is there a passionate ignition when feminine and masculine come together in marriage, that is, when soul and body come together, but when that happens, then earth and heaven can come together right through the body. Humans are the connectors between earth and heaven, and that's when the energy comes exploding through and out of the body.
Can you tell people how to get a hold of you on your website and
yes,
and how you also do coaching as well, and let them understand how
yes.
to do that? We're getting close to the end of our hour, but I
you
really
bet.
Think that it's important. Thank you.
My website is www.soulscriticalpath.com. In other words, take the apostrophe out of Souls Critical Path, just those three words together, .com. And on that website is a contact page which has my telephone number and an email. You can contact me either way. I do a free half-hour session that just talks about my work with clients so they can see if they resonate. And I'll also say that while I prefer to do this work face-to-face and on the table, I also do it over the phone. I can feel that pulse over the phone. I prefer to start a client on the table, but I've had very good response to people over the phone who can't get to where I am in northeastern New Mexico or when I do work up around Colorado Springs. So call and talk to me about it. The number that you'll find on that website is 575-779-9432. The email is john@davidson-heartworks, H-E-A-R-T, like the heart in your chest, works, W-O-R-K-S.com.
Very good, and I really like that you can do this distantly as well, you know, for those that can't get to your area in New Mexico. But it makes it very, and it's very personable on the phone, where it doesn't feel like it's as distant as what it used to be. I mean, I think that the energies today, you know, work a lot better now with all the different types and forms of communication that we have through email and Skype and the phone. And, you know, and I've met you personally, and you have a very soft effect with people, to which it's not that let's dig into the garbage, so to speak, of someone's baggage. It's more about, you know, what's your conceptual idea of how you are doing and where you're at, and you take time to find out where that belief system is.
Right. It's two different energies, and in a face-to-face session or on the phone, it works the same way. There's that first hour of kind of analytical conversation. We're going to be in our heads together a little bit so I can find your worldview. But when we get to the table, that goes away. I have to drop into my heart space to facilitate that session. And the client very quickly comes into a heart space. Even if the body isn't feeling safe, the heart space gets activated. Then we can work together. And that can happen over the phone just as easily as it can happen on the table. particularly if we've had some contact with each other that lets our feels get introduced to each other. So I wouldn't hesitate to check in on this process, even if you can't make it to northeastern New Mexico or Colorado Springs when I'm up there. I think you'll sense that as the energy shifts out of analytical retired lawyer kind of talking, as we've done on the radio here today, and get down to that heart feels connecting one with the other, lots of things can happen there. There's lots of magic.
Sorry about that. I lost contact with the show for a minute.
Okay.
And I'm back. Listeners, if you want to get this downloaded in out of the archives about 10 minutes after the hour, the archives will be open and ready for you to download this information. And please get in contact with John, as he has a very beautiful way of helping you, you know, develop your soul and body relationships so that the two can interact with each other and work more effectively, the way I see it, than the two working against each other so much. And with that, we're at the close of our hour, and thank you very much, John. You've been very informational and quite well. Your books are amazing and a very easy read. I would highly suggest getting his books. Are the books available on your website, John?
The books are available on my website. It links to my Amazon web page and the Amazon site. And Rhonda, thank you very much for this time today. It's just been delightful to be on your show today.
Well, thank you very much. And, you know, we'll talk about maybe you coming back and doing some more talking, and once you get your other books out and into the marketplace. Or maybe even talk about your sustainable community options that you are working with in New Mexico. I think, you know, a lot of us are trying to figure out how to do that so that we aren't hurting the earth as much as we have in the past. And go on ahead.
I was going to say all of the above. I'd be delighted to come back and talk about any of that.
All right. Thank you, John, so much. And
thanks,
everyone, have a great week and a great day. Make it the best one you can have. And we will see you again next week, or no, tomorrow on Friday on the Searcher's Roadmap at noon Mountain Standard Time. And then we'll be back again next week on Thursday at 11 a.m. Mountain Standard Time with Judith Light next week. And I will be anxious to hear any feedback. You can reach me at thesearchersroadmap@gmail.com. And just give us some feedback and let us know what you think of the show, and or if you have any ideas of something you would like to listen to or learn about. I will do my best to find someone who can touch on that subject. Thank you very much, John, and everyone have a wonderful week.
Thanks, Rhonda. Bye now.
Bye-bye.